Okay, I'm back. This is Mitch Axelrod. I want to thank you very much for joining me today. This is November 1st, 2008, and the conversation that we're going to have today is going to be sort of based on my 30 years of business, which I celebrated yesterday. October 31st was my 30th anniversary, and for 10,958 consecutive days, I have been self-employed, which means that nobody has written me a paycheck in 30 years. And so today I want to talk about and share and discuss with you, which means we can converse back and forth if you choose to, some of the most important things that I've learned along the way, and more importantly, you know, how do they apply to you, and how can you maybe not have to go through the 30 years that I did, you know, and that kind of strikes me as one of the first and most important things about what I've learned over the years is, and we all know this, but you can really learn a lot from other people. You can't experience life from other people. You have to experience life yourself, but you can learn an awful lot from other people. And so, you know, when you look back on your own life and your own accumulated experiences, it's not just what you experience, but it's also the learning that you get along the way from other people that can accelerate your path or remove obstacles before they show up. And so, you know, that's really what, for me, the game has always been about. It's always been about learning.
Paul Donahue.
Learning and sharing. Hi, Paul. Nice to have you. And then playing it forward, as I like to say. All right, because knowledge and wisdom stuck inside your head and used only for your own selfish interests or self-serving purposes is really a shame. It's a waste because knowledge and wisdom are meant to be shared. So not only has that kind of been what my life has been about, but it's also been what my business philosophy has been about. And so I'm going to share a little bit about that today. I promised to talk to you about some of the stories of how I made some deals happen along the way, some of the best deals I did. I'm also going to share with you a couple of the worst deals I did because I think I've learned more from my mistakes and setbacks than I've learned from my successes. You probably feel the same way. So I promised to share 30 nuggets or 30 lessons that I've learned. I don't know, maybe you'll count them. And there's a number of ways we can do this, but I feel like the best way would be for me to kind of take you through these three major categories of business, money, and life. And the different things that have happened and the lessons learned. And as I said before we got started, I would love to have this be a conversation. And although I do want to get as many of these 30 across to you, the richness is in the conversation because that's where the experience is. So I'm not going to count them. I'll leave that up to you. But I've certainly got, you know, plenty more than 30 here if I cover them all. And if I don't, so be it. You know, it's not so much about quantity as it is about quality. So I will open the lines. I'm going to keep them open, and I'm going to ask you if you would care to, along the way, if you would share a particular lesson or nugget of wisdom or something that you've gained from our relationship over the years, whether it's a long term. I mean, there are people who are going to be on this line who I've known for literally 20 and 25 years and done business with for 20 and 25 years. And there's people who have just joined our community. If you've just joined our community recently, you don't have the benefit of a long-term relationship, but I'm going to try to do my best here to squeeze 30 years into 90 minutes or 120 minutes. So if there's something that keeps you coming back, something that gets you wanting more, please share that along the time that we're together, okay? And so before I kick off, let me first just say thank you for being here today, and thank you for supporting me in the way that you've supported me over the years, because truth be told, although there is a me without you, there would not be any me from a business perspective without you. Business and money come from serving. And for me, really, life and work is all about serving. I live to be of service. I live to be of value. It's one of the core principles I hold, and I always give away at least 10% of my time every year in pro bono work. All right, I make it a point that no matter how many hours I choose to work, I make sure I give at least 10% of my hours away to people who need help, want help, are willing to do something with the help they get, but simply can't afford it. And you know, we all have our own way of giving back to the universe, giving back to the world, and thanking whomever and however for our blessings. And for me, it's always been more time. I give money, but for me, the value return and the pro bono is time and knowledge and experience and wisdom, because those things are really immeasurable. You know, if you give money, is good, and money is a wonderful thing to give. But to me, lasting value comes from giving of your time, being with people, present with people. Like, nowhere else I'd rather be right now than with you. It's also listening to people as to what it is that they really want, what they say, what they don't say, the words that come out of their mouth, the things that are left in the unsaid. Very often what's unsaid is even more profound than what's said. And one of the things that I've really conditioned myself to do, and it was very hard because I like to speak, as most of you know, and some of you are speakers, so you know how speakers love to speak. But the truth is, you learn so much more and you glean so much more and you gain so much more when you're in the listening. And when you listen, you can really tell if you're listening at a superficial level just so there's a break in the action so that you can jump in and speak, or are you listening at a deeper level where you're really listening with for understanding? You know, what is it the person's saying? What is it the person's not saying? And then there's even a deeper listening, which is kind of like listening to a person's soul. You know, and I know, I can tell if after 30 years, one of the things I've learned clearly is when I'm listening at the superficial level. And what I've learned to do is if I'm listening at the superficial level, either I immediately stop and move to a deeper level of listening, or I disengage from the conversation. And that's helped me preserve relationships over the years. I really genuinely feel strongly that one of the lessons, one of the nuggets, I'll just call them lessons, is that how you end relationships is critical. Because most of us are easy and good at starting relationships, but ending relationships is a most undervalued skill. Because if you believe that relationships are at the core of a good business, good money, and a good life, then it's the way life is. Not everybody comes into your life and stays into your life forever. People come, they go, they come back. Some come and go quickly and never come back. Some come and go and years later come back, you know. So it's very important how you end relationships. And I always endeavor, it doesn't always happen, but you try to end them cleanly, you know, where there's no baggage so that you don't have, unfinished business, so to speak. And we all have that. I mean, I could point to 8 or 10 people right now I probably need to clean something up with. So it's not so much about achieving perfection as it is being conscious and aware that, you know, let's do a little bit better every day, you know. And so being in the listening and disengaging at that superficial level, I believe, is a high integrity thing to do. Because here's the truth, and I probably learned this most from being with my son. Those of you who know me know I spent 10 years as a full-time stay-at-home dad raising my son. And you learn to listen probably best from your kids or from young people, because they call you on your stuff all the time. They don't let you get away with anything. And And so I learned that if I'm really not listening, but I'm pretending to listen, or I'm trying to listen with half an ear, I just would, it's better that I disengage from the conversation if I'm not prepared to go to a deeper level of listening. And I got to tell you, this may sound like a throwaway. It may sound like it's not that important. You know, you listen and however you listen, but I would say that very few things have served me better in life than listening and being a good listener and being willing to listen to people and knowing that you're listening superficially to either go deeper or disengage. Because I'm not sure that there's a more valuable thing that people seek than to be heard. And growing up the youngest of eight kids, of yours, mine, and our family, where literally for the first 8 years of my life until they were all out of the house and married, I virtually didn't say a word. You know, it's probably no big surprise I'm a speaker, or I do speak. You know, I'm pent up from my youth. But I literally just sat around and listened for 8 years and didn't really have the, you know, I didn't have the standing in the pecking order to really speak, you know. And with everybody else talking at once, you just didn't get a word in edgewise. So it gave me the first 8 years, literally, I did nothing but listen. And the rest of my life now I've been, you know, for the last 45, I've been speaking, catching up. But it taught me the value of listening to what's going on around you and getting a good sense of bearings. It's kind of like navigation. You know, if you really, wherever you are, however you are, if you're always aware of your surroundings, that will serve you well. And that's true for business. It's true for money. It's true for life. You know, so become more tuned into how you listen. And are you listening superficially? You know, are you listening for the deeper meaning? Somebody who just joined us, we have an echo. Can I ask you to just hit *6? Okay, thank you very much. Or are you listening at the really deep level, which is like soul to soul, you know? And that's not an easy thing to do, because when I first started in business in 1978, I was after my 3 months at Exxon, where I made those 5,000 cold calls, which if you've heard my story, you've heard that once or twice. I said I was never going to make another cold call again. And so I got into business on October 31st, 1978. I got my insurance license, and I began doing financial planning and insurance. And so my first foray into business was essentially I had to build a business from scratch, and I had to do it in without cold calling. And back in 1978, you know, who knew anything about marketing? I mean, if you look around you today, the abundance of marketing content, materials, strategies, tactics, approaches, not to mention the actual vehicles, is astounding. It's astounding compared to when I started back in 1978. I mean, just nobody knew anything about marketing, really. You know, you had to really build your business on relationships, and you had to contact people, and you had to decide, you know, how am I going to do it? Most of the time, you're either going to send out some sort of a mailing piece, or you're going to spend time on the phone and call people, all right? And so I did both. I sent out a newsletter. I picked about 100 people, and I sent out a newsletter. And more importantly is, like, every salesperson does in every business, you make a list of 100 people, all right? And you call those 100 people, and you start to build your business literally from your relationships out, all right? Today, obviously, the choices are astounding. You know, you don't even have to talk to anybody you know to have the potential to build a good business. So my strategy has always been relationship-based, all right? And by being able to listen to what people wanted and what they needed and who they were looking for and what they wanted out of life, it dawned on me very early that people wanted and needed to be heard. And that if even if that person wasn't a potential buyer for me, that person could lead me to somebody. Because if they have, people tend to hang around with other people like them. And so my strategy from the very beginning was, if I'm going to do business, let's say in financial planning, I want a certain type of client, let me talk to people, they'll know other people like them. And the philosophy always started with, let me get one. Let me get one. Then from one, I can go to two. From two, I can go to four. All right? And from four, now I have a business, and I'm on my way. Because now I can grow, if not arithmetically, I can grow geometrically. And by the way, that was something I've taken into every business that I've been in over the years, is that if you're starting from scratch, let's say, or you're redirecting, you've kind of gone through a transition in your life and you're starting over and you say, okay, I'm going to take my accumulated knowledge and wisdom, but I'm going to go into a new business or a new venture or a new practice. People say, what do I do? I say, go out and get one client, whatever size client that is. You got to get one. Now, if you're savvy on the internet, if you know how to do mass mailings, if you know how to do SEO, if you know how to do all of the internet-based marketing, and you have a system in place where you can handle hundreds, not one at a time, wonderful. But you still need to make one sale. You know, even if you're sifting through hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands, you still have to make a sale. So make your first sale. Get your first client. And what you learn from that process, you then can then apply and double, because usually if you get one, you're going to get two. They know somebody like them. So I got off on a tangent, as I'm apt to do. So I was about to make a point, and I got off on a tangent. And if any of you know where I started this little gambit, please bring me back. Because that's the nature of the way my brain thinks, is I tend to go off on tangents, you know, one thing leads to another. And oh, by the way, that is one of my greatest strengths, and it's also one of my biggest banes of life. It's one of the biggest challenges I have, is that when I live, you know, from my inside out, my nature is more creative. And so I get bored with doing something repetitively, yet ironically, I played baseball. I actually played semi-pro baseball back in 1981. I had a tryout with the St. Louis Cardinals. And in the sport, I was very disciplined. Okay, I could go out and field 100 ground balls in a day. I could take 100 swings in batting practice. All right. But when it comes to things like business and creativity, once I create it, I use it and to prove that it works, but then I want to create something off of that. And for years, that was both an advantage and a huge Achilles heel for me, because for those of you who know anything about our work in axiology, the science and study of human values, which I've been doing for about 17, almost 18 years now, one of the things we know is that there's three dimensions of value in the world. All right, the real words are intrinsic, extrinsic, systemic, but the words that I use are soul, role, and goal. It's a hierarchy of value around your soul, S-O-U-L, being more valuable than your role, R-O-L-E, and both being more valuable than your goal. All right, so it's kind of like the feeling dimension, the doing dimension, and the thinking dimension, all right? And those of us who spend a lot of time in the thinking dimension, like I do, but when it comes to actually following systems and putting systems in place, we're not very good at that. It becomes a real choke point in the business. And if that's how you are, you're more towards the creative side. Or you like to go out and get the business, but you don't necessarily like to do the business, if you follow what I'm saying, then it's all the more critical that you partner with people. One of the other lessons I've learned along the way is I am fiercely independent. I don't want anybody to step on my time. I don't want to show up where I don't want to show up. I don't ever want to punch a clock, all right? And at times that's really got in my way. It's limited me in terms of being able to interact in a world full of rules and systems and protocols and, you know, show up on time and do be there every day and all that stuff. And that's just me. So if you're like that, it would be very smart to be part of a team or partner with somebody who is systemic enough to be able to do the things that need to be done consistently. Otherwise, you get caught in your own trap. And that leads me to something else I want to talk about with respect to business. You know, business is very different today than it was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, when you went into business, you went into business. You didn't try a business for a week or a month or 6 months. You know, you didn't jump from one business to the next business to the next. No, some people did. But when you went into business, you went into business. You made it like it was at least a 1 to 3 year commitment, come hell or high water, no ifs, ands, or buts. And particularly so if you had a bricks and mortar business where you had to commit to leases, you had to commit to furniture, you had to commit to overhead for a year. You know, there was a time where when you went into business, you had better have some dough because, you know, you had to really go into business. And I think in a way, what's transpired over the past 30 years is now you can, quote, go into business for practically nothing. I mean, really nothing. $29, you can get a distributorship with a company. That's ridiculous. So I think in a way it's worse because people don't make the same commitment if they don't have as much money in skin in the game. So you think, well, a $29 investment, I'll try it, you know, and that's not the way you go into business, which back when I started, most people took a lot of time doing their due diligence to find a business that suited them. They didn't jump into a business because it wasn't cheap. And they committed to that business. So there was a lot more due diligence done up front, which I grew up in a due diligence world. So I have always done my due diligence. Now, does that mean I haven't made major mistakes? Of course not. And I'll share a couple of them with you shortly. But you've got to do your due diligence. Now, today you can get into a business with practically no money. So the commitment to make that business work isn't as great for most people that I see. And then the next challenge or trap is there's so many other businesses that appeal to you that might only cost $500 or $1,000, which is not major money considering you don't have to go open up a store somewhere and spend $50,000 on build-outs and leases and deposits and all that, equipment. So you say, I'll drop $1,000 and I'll go into that business. And then you get the gurus who say, no, and nobody in particular, that the way to financial independence is through multiple streams of income. Okay? Well, I would respectfully disagree with them. The way to financial independence is not through multiple streams of income, because multiple streams of income are active income streams, typically. Very few people have multiple streams of passive income, and fewer still have multiple streams of residual income. You know, there's three kinds of income. Active income, you work for it. Passive income, your assets work for it, or some sort of asset works for it. Residual income, either you have an asset that keeps paying off forever, like music royalties or book royalties or annuities, or you're in network marketing where you build a residual income team where, you know, you're getting a little piece of 10,000 people, okay? That's residual income. And there's very, very, very few different kinds of those things. So the idea of having multiple streams of income is nice in theory, but if those multiple streams of income require you to trade time to get them in place, what you're actually doing is you're diffusing your active income value in the marketplace by spending time on all these other different things which don't pay off right away and might or might not have deferred payoff, okay? And if you look at all the people who preach this, but you track them back into their own historical financial growth and wealth accumulation, here's what you find in most of them, with few exceptions. They got wealthy doing one thing until that one thing made them wealthy. And then they split off because they were able to take the wealth they produced from their active income, trading time for money, maximizing your value in the marketplace, getting paid what you're really worth, and then they took that active income after they got it to a point and that was sustainable, they then diversified. You know, I mean, look at your number one guy in the world, Warren Buffett. He sticks to the knitting to this day. Now he's sitting in a cash position. He's able to buy all this phenomenal opportunity. Even if 80% of what he's bought over the past 6 months doesn't work, which it's likely to, the other 20% will make him, you know, richer than rich he already is, because he's in a cash position and because he never loses sight of his core business. All right. So he practices at the highest scale what we ought to practice at whatever scale we're at, which is, what is the purpose of your business? Are you building a business to build business, meaning you're building it to sell it, cash it out, or pass it on to your kids, or build it for ego, or you're really going to build a business, all right? Or are you more the kind of person who wants to build a practice? Do you want to build a practice? If I look back over my historical 30 years, I'd say probably good two-thirds of it or more, maybe three-quarters of it, I really had a practice more than I had a business. Now, I have had businesses. The one business that we had the most employees, we owned a restaurant down the Jersey Shore in a little island called Long Beach Island, 1988, okay? That was the business. That was a business with employees, with overhead, with all kinds of, you know, stuff. It was a $1 million business. We didn't do $1 million in sales, but it cost me $1 million to buy the business, buy the property, all right? And that actually turned out to be one of my biggest losses then, and I did a ton of due diligence on that, all right? But unfortunately, I bought in 1988. I closed it in March, and by June, when the summer opened, we had the medical waste washing up on the shores of New Jersey, the entire eastern seaboard. And so, talk about lesson learned. In 6 months, $500,000 in cash gone. Next 6 months, $500,000 in equity gone. We paid about $1.1 million for the package. We had some investors. I was the bulk investor. So I did all my due diligence. I had it appraised three different ways. The land alone was worth $1 million. So we paid another $150,000 for the property, for all the equipment, for the goodwill, for blah, 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 blah. There's a case where I did all my due diligence and an external event like, you know, medical waste washing up on the shores of the beaches all throughout the East Coast, and bad media. The media went on TV and said there was a massive garbage slick heading for this place called Long Beach Island we were on. And then the next night they went on and said, you know what, we made a mistake. The garbage slick is heading out to Long Island, Long Beach, Long Island, not Long Beach Island, New Jersey, which was 150 miles away. And then probably 20% to 30% of the summer rentals dropped within 1 week, and we never recovered, okay? So there are times when you can do all of the due diligence. You can literally do a perfect analysis, and external events come along, and things beyond your control, and they can undermine you. You can let that destroy you, which it did almost for me for 2 years, because that was just the beginning of loss. That we lost, I personally lost $1 million in less than 12 months, and I went from having a $1.2 million net worth in 1988 to literally being minus $3.4 million in 1990. minus 2.2. I lost $3.4 million in 24 months. $1 million just in the real estate, that one vehicle. Okay? And understand that I started in 1981, after I came back from playing baseball, I started with $25 in my pocket in 1981. I had given up my financial planning and insurance business for 6 months to go down and play baseball. I was still young. I said, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it. It was great. I came back literally with $25 in my pocket and not much of a business really left over. People I had entrusted my business to basically, you know, I mean, they didn't have an economic stake in it, so it kind of disappeared. So I had to start all over again. And the point I'm making around this whole thing is, one of the points is, you really want to decide what kind of business do you want. What would be best for you? It's so hard today to insulate yourself from the crap, from the claptrap, and from all of the hype that's out there. And it's easy to get swept away in it because the people who have a business opportunity to sell you or they have a deal to sell you, you know, there is so much more abundant than they were 20 and 30 years ago. You could, you know, there weren't 150,000 different business opportunities out there, relatively speaking. Maybe there's less, I don't know. Maybe there's a million, who knows. But you didn't have the number of people clawing at you every day to do something. So if you're just starting or if you're in transition, my suggestion would be decide if you want a business or a practice. And it's fine to do either. You know, you really want to, whatever you decide to do, do it from the inside out. You know, trust your intuition. If you have clarity around intuition, trust your intuition. I didn't trust my intuition when I invested in that restaurant. I did my due diligence. I covered all of the financial aspects of making a good business decision, but I overrode my intuition. When I went out to buy, I didn't go out to buy a commercial property with a restaurant that could be turned into, you know, a development. I actually went out to buy a house, all right? And that was because my wife and I were renting every year for 6 years, and we decided this is silly. Why are we going to rent when we should buy something? And although prices had gone up, you know, we rented 2-3 weeks out of the summer. We could probably rent the place. And you know, so I went out looking to buy something for private rental, you know, personal use, and then we would rent it out when we weren't there. And instead, I wound up getting sucked sideways into this other business deal, which really looked good, and it was good, all right? But I didn't trust my intuition. I steered away from my intuition, and despite the fact that I did really good due diligence on the business and financial aspect of it, in an ironic sort of way, if I would have invested in the residential versus the commercial game, I would probably still own that house today. It would be worth a couple of million dollars, and it would be free and clear. Okay. So you can see that sometimes your decisions turn on, you know, do you trust your head or do you trust your heart? If you've got good clarity in intuition, trust your intuition. If you've got better clarity in your head, trust your head. And we, by the way, can measure that clarity using our assessment called the value profile. But you know, if you have good intuition, and most of us have a sense of intuition and we just don't trust it, I would say trust your intuition over your head, but make sure you do your due diligence, you know. And sometimes even when you do both, you can still wind up losing a big chunk of money or, you know, big chunk of self-esteem or a big chunk of self-confidence. When I lost that first million, I felt awful. And then when it just cascaded after that to the point where, you know, it was another couple of million, the extra amount of money wasn't all that much. It didn't matter that much. And really, when you lose 30,000 or you lose $3 million or you lose $3,000 or $300. It's not so much the magnitude of it, it's the loss of it. You know, so so one of the things you have to really do is, first of all, if you have losses, cut your losses fast as you can. You know, people keep feeding. I've seen people go down with the ship, and I have too. And that's why I've learned now, if something doesn't work, you know, cut it sooner than later. Investing more energy, hoping that something will turn around or hoping that something will change, is really counterproductive. It's also a terrible waste of life. And believe me, I can't tell you how many hours I've invested that way. So hope is not a game plan. Yeah, I listened I've done some political writing the past year and coming out with the New Game of Politics book soon, and because I feel like now is the right time, that politics and money and business and life are all converging, that we are being thrust into the political game simply because we can't not be. It's affecting everything that's going on. And you know, I keep hearing about hope as if it's a game plan. You know, we hope a better future. We can't hope a better future into reality. We have to trust there's a better future. We have to be committed to a better future. And we have to be willing to do what is necessary to create the circumstances around which we have a better future. This notion of hope is like, you know, maybe divinely somebody like the patriarch will bestow us with hope and that will lead to something. But it's really a vacuous phrase. And it took me years to catch myself that now I never use the word I hope. And when I do, I shouldn't say I never, I do use the word. But I stop right away and I say, oh, excuse me, I don't hope. I either know, I trust, I commit, or I'm willing. I don't know hope. Hope is a great thing to have, but it's a lousy thing to say. So my feeling is that if wherever you are, you've got to get out of hope, you know, have hope, be hopeful. Those are good things to hold as feelings, but it's not a good thing to language anything in the context of I hope, because immediately it takes it out of your hands. It takes it out of your sense of control. All right. And again, I'm not suggesting that there isn't some divine presence that could assist you. Not at all. But hoping is like when people lately talk about the law of attraction. I don't get into a conversation with them about it, but I state very boldly that I disagree that there is such a thing called the law of attraction. At best, it's a principle. It's not a law. If it were a law, then there are a lot of things we have to explain about attraction that don't seem to fall under the law of attraction. So at best, it's a principle. But even if you buy it, the idea that you can just sort of, you know, hope things to yourself is really silly. And now I hear kids saying it. I hear, you know, it's almost become such a natural part of our lexicon that we forget that we're not even conscious that we're saying it. It's one of the most disempowering words that you can use. It's a phenomenal state of being to be hopeful and optimistic and feel about what's possible. So if you catch yourself saying, I hope, maybe this trigger will go off for you and you'll say, no, I trust, or I commit, or I am willing, you know, but not I hope. You know, it doesn't take the place of a game plan. So if you have good intuition, trust your intuition. If your intuition says, you know, I don't really want to build a business. Maybe it's not my skill. It's not something I like to do. But I would really love to have a good practice. Then that's a whole different way to go about advancing your work. All right? If you want to be self-employed. And that's a critical decision. The other critical decision, which I've talked about a lot, but I will be repetitive with it here. I'll say it again, is the question, am I a jockey or am I a horse? Am I a jockey or am I a horse? I recognize for me that I am a horse. I'm a jockey too, because I've jockeyed other people's products and I've jockeyed other people's work. All right, but really, unless you're a unique person who can be both jockey and horse, meaning you're like me, I'm a jockey and a horse, but I would be far, far better off being a horse and getting other people to, you know, mount the horse, jockey the horse, put the saddle on the horse, feed the horse, clean the horse, because I have a stable of vehicles that can ride people into the money. If you have vehicles, and we all need vehicles, that you can help people ride into the money, that somebody else could hop in your vehicle or hop on your horse, and they could ride your horse into the money, then you are a horse. If you are a jockey, you are someone who needs a vehicle. You don't have your own vehicle, or you might have your own vehicle, but your own vehicle is not providing you with the economic payoff that you want it to, then find somebody else's horse that you can ride. And so this is so important in terms of the decision as to how you are going to be self-employed, have a practice, build a business, or remain employed or some hybrid, all right? And the beautiful thing about today is the flip side of all these business opportunities being so abundantly available, the good part about that is that you can find something, a vehicle that you can ride that won't compromise your ethics, won't compromise your integrity, that fits into your skill set, that enables you to do something you like to do, and that has the economic potential, because there's, you know, there's opportunity to make a living, dollar a living, all across the spectrum. Do you want to make 50 grand a year? Do you want to make 100 grand a year? Do you want to make 250 grand a year? Do you want to make $1 million a year? And how important is that? Now, I think a lot of people I meet, they want to make millions of dollars. Okay, everybody does. Would I rather make millions or hundreds of thousands? Okay, you know, obviously that's silly. Like, more is better. But more is not always better if the trade-off for more is not better. Let me say that again. More is not always better if the trade-off to get more is not better. If the trade-off to get more is that you're going to work yourself instead of working 12 hours, you're going to work 16 hours and have zero time or zero life, that's not worth it. So the choice that you make, and this is something I face every day too, especially being a horse and being somebody who's less suited to be a horse in terms of managing all these projects, I just want to create new horses. I want to go out and buy some new horses. I want to find some new horses. Well, who's gonna look after the ones we've already got? And if you don't get those horses, you know, fed and saddled and run, they're gonna shrivel up and die. They're just gonna become essentially, you know, non-producing assets, if you will. So if you're a horse and you've got assets, you've got intellectual assets, you've got products, you've got services, you've got deliverables that you could bring to the world, and other people could bring that to more people, then your job is to find jockeys. You should be finding jockeys. You should be looking for other people who can help promote you. Now, by the way, you could also be riding somebody else's horse and still be looking for jockeys, all right? In other words, for people who become distributors of a particular product line and they build their business not just by finding end-user customers, but by finding other distributors, you know, network marketing, direct sales, multi-level marketing, even traditional marketing in organizations. You know, you've got your marketing department, your sales department, and your service department. So really know yourself. I mean, I really should have started, maybe I did, I don't know if I did, to talk about that knowing yourself is the single most important thing of all. You know, that if you really know yourself and you're willing to look at yourself honestly, which is not always easy to do, that your greatest asset is knowing yourself. It's knowing your strengths. It's knowing what you do well. It's knowing what your passions are, and it's not. And it's knowing what you don't like, what isn't suited for you to be doing. And that's really harder today, I think, than it was 30 years ago. You know, even though the mindset 30 years ago was a mindset of working for somebody, being an employee. You know, I was pretty rare, I guess, in that back in 1978, not a lot of people went into business for themselves. But those that did were pretty much like me. They were psychologically unemployable because they knew that they didn't want to, you know, do their own – they didn't want to show up and be an employee. Now, in order to do that, you've got to be able to market and sell yourself. And so part of the whole idea of networking and being in business, and whether you're in a direct business, direct sales, or you're in a building a business and other people are going to be selling for you, or you're in a practice where you say, you know, like I did, the 10 years that I was home with Adam, I didn't have nor did I want to be responsible to have a business that had to be run. And probably in retrospect, it was one I should have. Because if I would have found other people, they could have run the business, and my role would have changed to managing the business and managing the people. But, geez, I hate to manage people. I love to coach people. I love to work with people. But, God, do I hate to manage people. All right? When I had my restaurant, my wife managed the people. I ran the business. I mean, I worked with the people, but she did all the scheduling. She did, you know, she did the liaison stuff. If they were fighting with each other, she'd step, you know, she did the managing. Even though I'm really good with people, there's a difference being really good with people in a context of marketing and selling and serving than managing. You know, and if you're in a business and you're growing a business, and you have multiple layers, you know, you start that next level where you have somebody between you and the people producing, like called a manager, you've got to really, really look at your skills and see if you're suitable for that. And if not, then you ought to find a manager, you know, because if you don't manage, if you need a layer between, you know, if your business is growing to the point or you're already in a business that's grown and you've got multiple layers of people, that's the hardest transformation for a business owner, is to go from being the business to running the business, you know, to then working on the business so you're not even involved in the business. So you're actually detached from the business. You're systemically working on the business so the business can run without you, all right? And that's a level that some of you may be at where you're saying, I'm mature enough in the business. Now I want to think about how can I make the business run without me, all right? And that's where you sort of now look at yourself as a horse and you say, how can my horse farm operate and run without me? So that means the horses have to be taken care of. They have to be entered into the races. Obviously, they have to win some money to keep the thing going, you know, that kind of thing. So if you kind of look at your business like a horse farm, if you're a jockey, then you really want to be looking at vehicles, horses, that predominantly, your predominant horse should be the one you're both most passionate about and most capable of doing, or most capable of learning how to do. A lot of people I've worked with, and I've had it with me too. I've gotten into some businesses that were just miserable busts. I had no business whatsoever being in these businesses. But, you know, I was excited about it. Somebody sold me on it, you know, and I did it. Like owning a racehorse back in 1984 or so. You know, I was a little flusher with money. There was a racehorse. The horse was a good breed. The guy who had done some syndications with me said, Mitch, you know, what do you think? Let's get this thing. We can get in. We only need two or three races, you know. So I jumped in, okay? And unfortunately, the horse never really made money. And when they put it out to stud, we didn't own the 12 inches of the horse that really mattered. So we only owned the piece of the horse that the nose of the horse, so to speak. If it ran in a race and it came in first or second or third, it came into the money. So so there's deals that you can get into that sound good, you know, either offbeat, but they sound intriguing, but they're not in the real mainstream of your business. And just like when you make an investment, any investment that you make, you better be able to lose it all if it's an investment. You know, people want a guarantee. They don't want risk. It's another thing I learned over the years is risk. Life is risk. If this notion that there's no risk, that you can mitigate risk, in my opinion, is one of the most dangerous things, because no matter what you do, you get up in the morning, there's risk, okay? So the shift in thinking around risk is that everything has risk. It's just different levels of risk. So if everything has risk, then your job is to manage the risk as best you can and to know what your comfort zone is, to know what your risk tolerance is. I had 10 years I spent in the financial planning business from 1978 to 1988. I lost sleep at night so many times, and especially from 1986 to 1988, when 1986 they changed the tax law, the real estate industry nosedived. It was called the Tax Reform Act of 1986. If you're losing sleep, you're not in a good business, okay? Or if you're losing sleep for whatever reason, you're not in a good business. It means that whatever's going on in your life, there's too much risk, there's too much anxiety, all right? And life is too short. I spent a lot of sleepless nights in the 1980s. And, of course, you know, I mean, it's even still to this day. The last couple of years, I've spent a lot of sleepless nights worrying, not worrying about people's money per se, but worrying about the state of the world and the future for my son and what is it all going to mean, you know, 10, 20 years from now, and where is our country going and who have we become, and, you know, some of those existential questions that you have a time to think about if, you know, if you make the time. So if you're right now in stress or anxiety, you're losing sleep, then you want to look at how are you managing risk, and not just financial risk, but risk in terms of understanding that everything has risk. Nothing goes up forever. This notion that the stock market, when it hit 14,000, was going to go to 40,000 was just – it's silly. It's folly. And obviously, you know, it didn't – stop there, came back down, adjusted, real estate, same thing. What goes up eventually comes down if the marketplace can't afford to maintain artificially high prices. And interestingly enough, and I'm tangentially moving, but as an aside, you're starting, if you're paying attention now to online promotions, particularly if you're tied into the marketing community, particularly inside the sub-level of the marketing community called the information marketing, you're seeing a major transformation going on, which, as humbly as I can pat myself on the back, I predicted 2.5 years ago on the platform, on the main stage, when I was the keynote speaker at the system seminar, and I said it won't take 2 years, maybe it'll be 2 years at the most, maybe less, that not only will the internet marketing community transform, I also said that the internet, we shouldn't call it internet marketing, we should call it internet sales, because internet selling is what you're doing. You're not really marketing, you're selling. All right, marketing is attracting people, selling is what happens when people buy stuff. But I said in 2 years or less, the internet marketing community, particularly the information marketing, is going to have a tainted perception of it. It's going to taint itself, because it's like the Wild West, anything goes. And within 2 years, people are going to say internet marketing, it's going to feel the same way as network marketing feels. And if you mention network marketing to 100 people, 90 of them will probably shiver and tremble. right, because they've had a bad experience, even though the model called network marketing may be the salvation for most people who don't have residual income, yet the very thing that could be salvation could be the one thing you must do, you won't do because you've got the shiver me timbers from a bad past experience. And I said, because I could see what was happening. And sure enough, here we are 2 years, 2.5 years later, and the whole industry's gone through a transformation. You know, the product launches have run their course. People are sick of getting 47 different promotions in their email box. They're unsubscribing from newsletters by the bundles because it's, you know, promotion. There's no added value. And besides which, I have a ton of programs I bought on my shelf, and I'm not using them. I'm not buying anymore. And so here's where the other part of the transition is occurring, and this really speaks to one of the core principles of my business for the last 30 years. You'll notice that the continuity model, what I mean by that is you've got people who were doing internet marketing, selling a high price package or medium price package, $200, $500, $1,000, $2,500, whatever, all right? That was the sale. And then you were stuck to implement it on your own. And there was no back end except when they either sold more of the same product, you know, false scarcity. We only have 1,000 of them. You get now, 6 months later, we just happen to find another 1,000 of them. All right, we're just opening this up for 24 hours so you can slide in. All right, that was the model. And they realized that that's not a smart business model. If you can sell 50,000 units of what you have and you shut it down at 2,000 because you want to create fabricated scarcity, you may seem like you know what you're doing, and certainly you could promote through a network of large mailing lists and get a result, but that's not a business, and it's certainly not a business anybody else is going to replicate who's not in the inner circle of people who promote, you know, and reach a million people. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about right now, what I'm referring to is these joint ventures that are happening where people are essentially incestually selling each other's mailing lists and endorsing their friend's product and doing these big product launches and saying we only have 1,000 or 2,000, okay? Well, first of all, that's not a business because would Coca-Cola say, we're sorry, we don't want to sell you any more Coke, we're just going to cut it off at, you know, 4 billion bottles? Of course not. And then secondly, what it does is this. It doesn't have you keep a customer for life. If all you do is sell me stuff, but I don't get any results with the stuff you sell me, and you don't add any value on the back end that helps me actually get results with the stuff you already sold me before you sell me new stuff, then I'm not going to be your customer for life. I'm certainly not going to be your customer for any length of time. And every good business person knows it's not the front-end sale that makes your business sustain itself. It's the long-term people coming back for more, coming back for more, coming back for more, whatever that more is. And so now all of a sudden, it's like they've discovered fire. The continuity model will give you that $1,000 course for nothing, just to show you how magnanimous we are, all right? And what we're going to do is we're going to make our money by you being in our community, because just showing you what to do and how to do it is not enough. You have to get results with it, and the way you get results is through continued application. And the way that you continually apply what you learn most often is having somebody, some third party, either help you be accountable, coach you, mentor you, monitor you, whatever. All right? And so now all of a sudden the model has changed. And you can buy that $1,000 package that a year ago would have cost you $1,000. You can buy it for the hard cost plus shipping, $37, and get the whole course. But now you're going to commit to $99 or $199 or $299 a month. And that monthly membership, that monthly continuity, all right, subscription, whatever you want to call it, community, is where I'm going to make my money because, first off, I would rather have a $100 a month customer who buys at $100 a month consistently than I would making one $1,000 sale. Why? Because if I have 1,000 $100 a month customers, that $100,000 a month, which brings in $1.2 million a year, is more valuable as an asset for somebody to buy from me or for me to sell or for me to, you know, whatever I want to do, than if those same 1,000 people bought $1,000 worth of product once a year, because there's no continuity. Because 500 of those people or 700 of those people or 900 of those people might not buy anything next year if they spent $1,000 with me last year. Whereas the $100 a month person, even if I only keep 40 or 50% of them, because it's less of an upfront commitment, because it's monthly, because it's, and if I'm adding enough value to justify it, that asset is worth more. And I don't have to work as hard because my role is not to bring a ton of people in on the front end every year. It's to one time bring a ton of people in on the front end, then shift my attention and my activities from marketing to serving. So this shift in what's going on in the internet world, we've been teaching for 15 years in the real world, in the offline world, which is the fundamental distinction of what I would term the new game of business and the new game of selling is that we flip the model upside down to a certain degree. All right, the traditional model of business is marketing, sales, service, in that order, linearly. So marketing is an investment. Sales are income or revenues. And service is an investment, expense, right? So the traditional model of business, which has been around forever, is that marketing and expense is what you do to attract people to you. Sales, which turns into revenue, is when you convert them from browsers to buyers. And then service, which is another expense for most companies, is where you keep them, where you pay a department to make sure they stay as customers, especially if they're buying something every month. But even if they're only buying periodically, semi-annually, annually, the investment in service on the back end is designed to keep them, all right? And that's the traditional model and how it's been forever. But imagine when you play the new game, which we've been literally teaching now 15 years, a little more, started in 1991, and you imagine that service is what you do from the first time you meet somebody. So your marketing, I like to say that the new game of marketing is not marketing. The new game of marketing is serving. The new game of marketing is really adding value in advance. The new game of marketing is really loving your customer enough, your buyer enough, to give them value from the very first time you meet them, however you bring them to you. And now with social media, the new game of marketing is relating. You know, so there's a massive, massive transformation in not the tactics of marketing, but in the ethos of marketing, in the context of marketing around which this function called marketing exists. It's an unbelievable transformation. I would bet that in another couple of years, a lot of the traditional marketing is gone. It's history. Well, I mean, you already see it. Look at advertising. The whole advertising industry is in turmoil. They're in upheaval, all right? But here's the transformation. Here's the real game changer, is that you turn service not only to be something you do from the first time you meet people, but on the back end, you turn service from an expense department into a profit center. So it almost becomes this, instead of marketing, sales, and service, it becomes serve, deliver, serve some more. Serve, deliver, serve some more. You serve on the front end, all right? You add value. You become the trusted advisor in whatever niche you're in, whether you're working in a practice or you're working to build a business. You want to be that trusted advisor. You want to be the first choice. You want to be the preeminent, most compelling business to do business with, or certainly as close as you can get to that. You serve. You deliver. Once they buy into you that you can serve and they buy your product or service, you deliver, meaning you deliver what you promise and then some. And then on the back end, you serve some more. And when you serve some more, you turn a expense department, traditionally known as customer service, where some companies even teach their people to get off the phone as quickly as possible with people. Instead, you use customer service to cultivate and advance relationships and teach those people conversion skills, relationship building skills, advancing the relationship building skills, questioning skills, listening skills, and in 3 minutes, instead of getting the person off the phone and saying, hey, we just solved another person's problem, you actually turn that person into a next buyer. And if that person is not going to be a next buyer, you don't know what they're going to buy next, you don't know when they're going to buy it next, but they love being a customer, then you segue into referrals and endorsements and testimonials. Not one in 1,000 companies in the marketplace today plays this game. That's why so many companies have sent their customer service departments to foreign countries. One of the bigger games that we're looking to play and partner with the people that come on board with us in various ways is to go into companies and show them the value of keeping their customer service department in America and using that customer service department in a new way to turn it into a profit center. So now look at what happens here. When you shift from the old model of market, sell, and serve, which, by the way, still exists, it hasn't disappeared. It's just different. And you embrace this new model of serve, deliver, and serve some more. Here's what happens. Marketing on the front end, the cost of marketing drops dramatically because not only are you taking advantage of the low-cost word-of-mouth, social media, buzz and all those things that happen from person to person, but you're also transforming on the strategic end of marketing from let's go and scream from the mountaintops how great we are and where we are and who we are and pound it into them through repetition, which is very expensive, to let's serve them from the first time we meet. So to give you a real hard practical example, from the very first day I got into financial planning, with this philosophy, back in 1978, we gave away a free consultation. We gave away free education. All right, we gave away a free newsletter. Now, bear in mind, I didn't know much, nor did my partners know very much about marketing. But we knew people, and we knew how to relate to people. And so we added huge value up front, where everybody was selling insurance and going in and doing a presentation on insurance, we were going in and asking a whole questionnaire of questions that people had never been asked before. We were doing real financial planning. And the first time it was free. So we added value up front, meaning from the very first time we met somebody, we served them. And if you play the new game of business, if you play the new game of selling, if you've been doing work with me for any extended period of time, you know that from the first time that you come into our community, even though we're not the most organized, you have an abundance of value added that you can tap into. We give away more content than most people charge for. Okay? I invented the phrase, give away the what, charge for the how, way back in the early 1980s because I realized that if I told you what to do and I gave that to you, that at least 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 10 people would come to me and say, okay, that's great. How do I do it? So I was willing to give away the what and charge for the how. And when I went into corporate consulting, I did the same thing. I would do a presentation. My presentation wouldn't be a sales pitch. My presentation at the end of 45 minutes would be a game plan as to what could you do as a company to accomplish what you wanted to accomplish. And I'd throw in, you know, a couple of pieces of advice along the way. Why? Because I recognized that if I served from the very first time, I wouldn't have to continue to spend money to market to people. Either they'd be attracted to me or they wouldn't. And if they wouldn't, if you're not attracted to me when I'm serving you, then why the hell should I continue to market to you? Does that make sense? I'll just assume it does, right? I mean, if you're going to go out and serve people and they don't want you to serve them up front, why waste another dime in marketing to them? Now, again, don't take anything I say as gospel. Don't take anything I say as absolute. And don't take anything I say as black or white. I'm just floating a philosophy and sharing how I've done it, all right? Because, sure, there are times where you want to blitz the market, and it's something I never did because I never really wanted to spend a lot of money on marketing, although in the early 90s I spent a lot of money on advertising in full-page ads and major financial and insurance and sales magazines. Still have these ads promoting the first program I ever did called 21 Ways to Double Your Sales. We took out full-page ads in financial magazines and in Personal Selling Power and sold thousands of units just using an 800 number, shipping the product out, you know, traditional stuff. But other than that, I never did a lot of real costly advertising. You know, part of that was also to put my face out into the world. You know, I figured if I'm going to spend money, I'll reinvest it back in advertising. And even if people don't buy, they'll say, this is the guy who has 21 ways to double your sales. And it's spillover, by the way, in that advertising was that because I wrote the ad, not like an ad, I wrote it, you know, in like a special report. And it was a long copy ad with my picture, and, you know, it was a traditional, more direct response ad. It gave me positioning, too. So if I were calling companies for consulting work, I'd say, oh, by the way, did you see my ad running in Personal Selling Power? I'm the guy who promotes and sells 21 Ways to Double Your Sales. Would you be interested in 21 Ways to Double Your Sales? We've got a little background noise. If you've got some background noise, just do me a favor, hit star 6. So we had this ad going, and so not only did the ad bring in orders more than enough to cover the cost of the ad and make us money, but because of the way that we and I learned this really from Jay Abraham, which I've shared in other calls, my relationship with Jay and Brian Tracy and investing in those guys early in the game, almost $30,000 in 1988. In 1989 between the two of them. But that paid off to the tune of about $1 million over the next 5 years. So you know, you really want to look at making the best use of your assets. If you're going to do advertising, you're going to do direct mail, whatever you do, make the best use. You make it so that you could not just use it once, and if it doesn't work, you throw it away. Everything has long-term value. I could go back to that very ad. I could run that very ad right now, and I bet we could sell a lot of product, all right? Except now we're giving away 21 ways, and let me take a minute here just to kind of close this first part out. The major transformation in the new game of business and selling is this. If you can serve, deliver, and serve some more, you essentially reduce your marketing cost dramatically. You can boost your sales which is revenue and income, dramatically. If you learn better ways to convert, and I'm not talking about closing a sale. All right, closing a sale is that's old game terminology. I'm talking about converting somebody from a browser to a buyer. The program, there's no better program on the planet, in my opinion, and I'm biased, so take it from there, than the new game of selling. The new game of selling is the most comprehensive and proven way, with a $2 billion track record behind it, of how you can convert people from browsers to buyers. But here's the other part of this, all right, because that's revenue. The third part is now when you serve people, instead of it being an expense to service people, it becomes a source of profit. So if you can turn your service after somebody is a customer into new business, an upsell, a cross-sell of somebody else's product, a bump, meaning, you know, they add something on, or they buy again, or they do none of those, but they stay a customer for life or for the foreseeable future. And if none of those, you get referrals, testimonials, and endorsements, the back end, the service function of 99 out of 100 companies today that are operating in the red because they look at service as an expense department could within 6 to 12 months completely turn their service department around and change the game into a profit center. And now look at what happens. You've got two profit centers, sales and service, and one expense center, marketing, which is deeply, deeply, dramatically lower and less expensive if you're doing the serving from the beginning, as compared to the old game model, market, sell, serve, expense, income, expense. You've now transformed your business, whether you're sitting at home around your kitchen table, stuffing and packing envelopes, whatever it is that you do, or you're a mega, mega, mega corporation like MetLife or Prudential that we've worked with. It's just a matter of scale. By turning customer service into a profit center, you now not only transform your business from a spiritual point of view, from an ethical point of view, from a positioning point of view, but you transform the economic model from two expense departments having to have one income center called sales support two expense departments and still make a profit, to now having two income departments, sales and service, and one expense department called marketing that could be reduced over time dramatically the more you serve, deliver, and serve. Again, serve some more, okay? And when we've worked with companies over the years, the one thing that I've looked at is where is the leverage point that if we could press the leverage point could most quickly produce the result. And that's why we've been able to really have not just a massive impact on the lives of people in terms of the quality of their life and the feelings that they have about what they do, but we've been able to have a direct impact on the top and bottom line because we look at this picture holistically and with a whole new lens, a whole new prism, okay? So I'm going to take like a 5-minute, you know, take a sip of water. I would love to have you, if you're still with us, if any of you want to jump in here and let me know if there's been something valuable so far. I've got about another, I don't know, I've covered a bunch, but there's a few more important ones I want to talk about, some experiences I've had and some specifics on money and business in particular. But let me take a, you know, open it up to you because you've been patient and quiet. Would you like to share something of value, the lesson, something you've gotten so far, or anything you'd like to say? Please come on out, and this is the time. Just come off of mute if you're in Star 6 and jump on out, and let me hear from you. Okay, you have nothing to say, huh? All right. Well, I'm giving you the opportunity to come out and either say, hey, tell me more about this, or anything you'd like to say, please jump in. And if you don't jump in, I'll keep going. All right, while you're thinking about whether you're going to jump in or not, let me use this as a time just to remind you that, you know, the past 30 years for me are probably going to be very different than the next 30 years. And the project or the initiative that we're going to be working on over the next year, we're launching, we officially launched it yesterday, is called the Player for Life. And many of the programs which I'm going to share with you I've developed over the years, I'm going to tell you how I did it in this next segment, things like 21 ways to double your sales, 10 powerful marketing strategies, success abilities, 21 life skills for the 21st century, programs that that essentially I've generated, I don't know, a couple of billion dollars of revenue, most from these for our clients, a few million for myself, a product called Sales Alchemy, which I developed in 1996, two-video set. Brian Tracy does the introduction. It's about how do you turn your customers into gold. I would argue that in today's world, more than ever before, more than any time I've ever seen, it would be good for you to learn how to become an alchemist. An alchemist is somebody who transforms something into something else. You know, the historical of it is transforming metal into gold. And in 1996, I did a two-hour program, video program, which is going to be all, that's going to be included in the Player for Life, called Sales Alchemy, Turning Customers into Gold. And I talked about how important it is for you to realize that no matter who you work for, who cuts your check, who writes your, you know, your paycheck, you are a virtual entrepreneur. And in 1996, I also coined that term and created a product called the Virtual Entrepreneur Success Kit. In fact, this was the very first product we sold online. It was the end of 1996, I believe, 1997, early 97. And it was basically a little four audio tape cassette package of four different talks I had done on four different areas of business that I felt you needed to be as a fundamental basic virtual entrepreneur. And one of the skills of being an entrepreneur is being an alchemist. And so if you're not an alchemist, then you probably want to study with an alchemist, somebody who knows how to turn whatever it is into gold. And part of what the Player for Life program is about is really to help you become an alchemist. It's to help you to take the best of my entire life's work, which is going to be probably at least 100 hours on audio, a couple of dozen hours of video, models, worksheets, things like that, and become an alchemist in your life. And to be able to go back and say, okay, this week I want to work on this particular skill, or I have this particular challenge, or I have this great opportunity, or I'm going to go out and meet with somebody who can open the door. Go into the library, the Player for Life library, and see by category what is it that can help you right then, right there, right now. And so alchemy is the ability to transform ideas into gold, or relationships into gold, or whatever it is that has raw asset potential, and turn that into gold. And over the years, although I never, ever would position myself as somebody who's, you know, everything he touches turns to gold. First of all, that's not true. Anybody who's really been successful has had far more failures than successes, if you want to use the term failure. It's not about everything you touch turns to gold. I mean, there are some people who literally, you know, they just know how to manufacture money. All right, I've never been one of those. But the idea is to turn what you have already into gold. To turn your skills, your talents, your abilities, your contacts, your relationships, the people you know, all right, the experiences you had, the track record, everything, you turn it into gold. And that's never going to be more important than today, because 30 years ago, if you didn't want to be self-employed, you could get a job. All right? I mean, it wasn't like if you had some skills, you had desire, you could get a job. And you could probably get a job in a place where you could advance and the whole bit. Today, you just don't know that you can get a job. If you're in a tenured position, if you've been with a company a long time and you know you're going to retire with them, or you're in a position where they can't let you go, okay, then you're in a good spot. But for the probably 70 to 80% of the people today, there's no guarantee that your job's going to be available. Job insecurity, I don't think, has ever been higher. And so people are nervous, and they're wondering about, how am I going to be an alchemist? How am I going to be a virtual entrepreneur if I don't have the skills? Well, if you don't have the skills, then align yourself with somebody who does. Work with and or for somebody who does. Because if you don't, it's not likely you're going to pick those skills up off the street. You know, it's not everywhere. I mean, yeah, you could buy 100 programs, people are going to tell you how to make money in every possible way. But knowing how to make money in a particular way does not necessarily mean you're an alchemist, although obviously it would seem that that would be the case. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not saying if you go out and learn how to be, let's say, buy foreclosures, okay, fine. So you can turn foreclosures into money. That's one source of alchemy. I don't know that, you know, we don't need more than one. We need at least one. So whatever it is, find one source of alchemy that enables you to turn something, an asset you have, even if that asset is your time, into money. And if you don't have the one that you want, or if you're not feeling like yours is the best you can offer, then align with somebody else. So part of Player for Life, what motivated me to do this, which is partly insane in a way, because if you aggregated all the different programs and learning modules and courses and stuff, and individually you purchased them, you'd probably spend anywhere from 10 to 20 grand. I haven't figured out the exact number yet, because we're going to keep adding more content as we go forward. But the other part of it is that you might find something in there that is just the thing you need for just the main area that you're working. And so it's not so much about having just access to a encyclopedic library. That's not, you know, where if you go do a term paper, you go look it up, otherwise you won't use it. The idea is that there's something in this library that will be directly applicable to your primary work, the primary thing that you're doing to turn whatever into gold, to be an alchemist, to be a virtual entrepreneur. Or even to get a job and position yourself and language yourself and communicate your value in a higher and better way than you would otherwise, all right? So that's the first part of Player for Life, and I decided, rather than me have 100 different products to sell in the next iteration of our catalog, I'm going to take a whole bunch of these, put them under one label, call it the Player for Life, and give you essentially access to my best stuff over the past 30 years, all right? And initially it's going to be a digital kind of access. And then I went and I thought, you know, I'm really passionate about helping people under 25, because I have a son who's going to turn 20 soon, and I've taught him a lot of what I know, and he's gained some of it by osmosis. But there are not a lot of kids today under 25 who really are learning the fundamentals of real-world life skills and business skills. And many of them now, especially going forward the next few years, are not going to be able to afford college. They're not going to be able to get the loans to go to college. And many of them already in college are not learning what they really need to know to be good in the world as it exists today, not the world that existed yesterday, which is typically what our educational system teaches people, how to live in the world that no longer exists. And that's for a whole other conversation. All right. But one of my passions is to arm kids with the real world life and business skills. And so I decided that everybody who becomes a Player for Life will get a second free membership they can gift to somebody under 25. So it's kind of like a two for one. All right. When you look at the value of this, it's not even a question of value, because where could you get, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 worth of actual materials, let alone the experience and wisdom of 30 years, for $999, which is what the price is going to be. But I extended an invitation to the people in my world that if you become one of the first 100 people, which will enable me to do some good things that I want to do, and enable me to help you also get smoother, crisper, better access to the Player for Life, then the first 100 people can come in at $500, okay? So essentially for a one-time payment of $500, you're getting access to most of my life's work. You're getting a second one for somebody 25 or under. And then you also get to participate in what we do going forward for the next year at no charge. The other thing you then get is to become a partner for life, meaning as a horse, I realize what I have not done anywhere near as well as I could have, and shame on me, but that's going to change, is I have not provided the ideal and optimum conditions for the people who want to ride my horses into the money to ride my horses into the money, all right? Part of that is because I'm systemically challenged, and I just don't pay attention to, you know, providing the perfect system. I'd rather work with somebody who's already riding and say, come on, let's ride together. But I also realize that that's an easy thing to overcome. I just don't do it myself. So the other half of Player for Life is Partner for Life. And what that means essentially is that as a Player for Life, you will then get assigned a number, a code, a player code. And if you choose to share the Player for Life program with other people, and any of those other people decide to invest in it, you will get paid a 40% player's fee. So you are now our partner. Now, if you invest in Player for Life and you don't find it valuable enough to use it, you're certainly not going to find it valuable enough to recommend it. All right? So I acknowledge that. And my job and my goal is to get you to use it, which, you know, most people who invest in it are not going to invest in it if they don't plan to use it. Thing is, you don't have to use it by next Friday. You have the rest of your life to use it. I've been using all this stuff for 30 years. Some of it I use every day. Some of it I use occasionally. Some of it I use rarely. And some of it I stopped using. It worked so well, I stopped using it. You know, we're all guilty of that. So the other side of this Player for Life is Partner for Life. And Partner for Life essentially says that not only do you have the ability and the wherewithal to recommend it and get paid should somebody decide to buy it, but you also can partner with us, meaning I want to get Player for Life. It's next phase of it. When it goes to the $9.99 full price, it's going to be delivered in an MP3 player. So you'll have your own little personalized, you know, private MP3 player, which will say Player for Life, and it'll have much of it will be preloaded, all right, so that the person gets the physical product along with the disc with the content and the materials at the full price, and they have their Player for Life MP3. And then anything new or anything they want that we didn't put on the player, they can download to the player. So now they actually have their own Player for Life player, all right? The other part of it is you may know somebody, like you may know a person who wants to provide 10,000 students or people under 25 with really good quality, real-world skills, business skills, life skills. And that person may be willing to invest $10 a person, okay? And I'm just picking a number. Say they have $100,000 they'd like to invest. And we could go to them and say, for $100,000, what if you could put Player for Life into the hands of 2,000 kids? And the total would be $50. Or maybe better yet, what if we could put it in the hands of 10,000 kids and we could assign all 10,000 a username and password? And by the way, what I'm suggesting here, what I'm talking about here, is the way that I essentially built my intellectual assets over the years and sold them by using a philosophy that I don't know anybody else who's coined the phrase. I certainly have been doing it. I don't just sell to people. I sell through people. I don't sell to corporations, just, I do, but I would prefer to sell through them. If I can sell through MetLife, MetLife might have 5,000 sales agents, let's say. All right. When I did the deal with Mutual of New York back in 1991, Money, M-O-N-Y, they were 12th largest insurance company. They had 4,000 salespeople. I licensed a training program to them for $250,000 in 1992 that they could reproduce and give to all 4,000 of their salespeople. All right. And I won that piece of business ahead of Stephen Covey and Brian Tracy and Tony Robbins because I knew that they didn't want to keep buying new workbooks every year, new audio cassettes every year. They turned over 20% of their field force every year. So I said, I'll give you for $250,000, plus you film it so I have it. I'll be your partner. You can then make copies of these, as many as you want, going into the future. You don't have to pay me any additional royalty. All right, but I get the ownership of the product. You pay me $250,000 up front. You pay me another $100,000 or $200,000 in consulting fees. And so I made a deal with them that none of these other guys made, and I wound up getting a huge piece of business, whereas these other competitors of mine thought they were in the workbook business. They thought they were in the audio business. We got some interference. I don't know. If you've got, if you're on a cell phone or something, just hit *6, please. And so what I'm suggesting here is not only do we, we've got some little background noise. It's, if you would hit *6, I appreciate it. So as a partner for life, you not only have the ability to send people, let's say, to the website and the webpage to sell the player for life. And, of course, you wouldn't recommend it if you weren't behind it. But you also have the ability to look at other organizations that might want to license it, and we can license large quantities for a modest amount of money because we're not producing necessarily a hard good, especially if we're licensing it to companies who would then give it to people under 25 because all those people are digital. They don't necessarily – they have an iPod or they have an MP3 player. They could just download everything onto it, okay? So that's the other half of Player for Life is Partner for Life is that we've got some background noise from somebody, so I need to ask you all to hit *6. I don't want to have to go on mute, although I may have to. There we go. That fixed it. Nope, it didn't. Hold on a second.
Q&A mode is on. Participants may now unmute themselves.
Okay. So that's the other half of Partner for Life, or Player for Life is Partner for Life. And the possibilities there are pretty significant. So I won't go more into detail there, but if you are inclined to be a partner with me for the foreseeable future, if you feel like I'm a horse you can ride, then Player for Life is a program that would serve you well. Value-wise, you're going to get access to everything. And if not, you know, that's fine, too. Maybe you know somebody who would be. And the other thing I'll say is, for those of you, I put it out, if you do it this weekend, you're also get 15 minutes with me to see if we can't do some sort of a second opinion and help you in any particular way possible. Now, let me also suggest that if you have intellectual property, and I know a couple of people on the line do, this is the way that I built, as I mentioned in the letter, my intellectual property over the years. And I have what amounts to a multimillion-dollar library of intellectual property. And I did it with OPM, other people's money, 100%. The only time I ever paid anything out of pocket for this multimillion-dollar content library is in 1992, when I paid $25,000 to have somebody create my large sales workbook called Max Sales. It was 450 pages, 37 modules, and I needed somebody to put it together. But I had already signed the contract with Mutual of New York. So The truth is, even though I didn't get my first installment until after I had to lay out the $25,000, and I laid that out in pieces, I really didn't have to pay for that either. Okay? And if you want to be in the content business, there's a lot of people who are going to sell you packages and how to create content, and we have one of those too. It's also included in the Player for Life. It's called How to Turn Your Information Assets into Big Bucks. I did a seminar for Steve and Bill Harrison a couple of years ago. I also did a workshop. There's a PowerPoint presentation. Then I did a follow-up four-hour training program to talk about how do you take your intellectual assets or your information assets and turn them into big bucks, all right, easily into six figures and possibly into seven figures and more. And this is long before everybody started coming out with courses and training about how to create a product. See, there's a really important distinction here. Anybody can create a product. Creating a product does not put you in business. Anybody can create a product, especially an information product. People think that, you know, creating the product is the greatest thing in the world because you want passive income, and who wants to work anymore? You don't want to travel. So instead of speaking and traveling and everything else, you create an information product, you sell it on the internet, you get rich. Okay? Well, that works for about 2% of the people. And most of the time it's working for the 2% of the people who have their own product that already has a market place of people hungry for it. So I do not recommend that you go and, you know, interview six people, and you could do that. Don't get me wrong. You could do that. But that's not creating a product. That's creating essentially a little library, but having six people give you six different points of view on leadership is not a game plan for leadership. You'd be better off going out and doing an intense research for 6 months on a game plan for leadership that you know works, test it out, and then do what I did. All of my products did not come from me synthesizing somebody else's information, creating the product, and then going out to try to sell it. All of my products came from sales that were already made. If you're still on this call and you're hanging in there, what I'm about to tell you, if you have any inclination to be in the information business, is worth more than all the money you've already spent on information products combined, all right? And I don't say that to brag. I say it because I had to learn these lessons the hard way, but I also was smart enough to realize from the very beginning, way back when I did my first program in 1983, called Reality of Change, Shifting Economic Tides. Now, it's interesting. That was the title of the very first program I ever did live. And you could probably apply it to today, too, right? The Reality of Change, Shifting Economic Tides. And that's really where we are again, 25 years later, we're still facing the reality of change and shifting economic tides. Truly astounding. If you want to create products that are definitely have saleability, then create products from things that people already buy. Or, like, for example, this, what we're recording here today, even though nobody's buying this and we're not going to sell this, this is an amazing bonus. If you're listening to this and you're still here, you say, wow, we're getting some, you know, real-world stuff here. Now, I have no intention of selling this, but everything that I have ever done, I've recorded almost. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is to recognize that if you want products that are actually going to sell in the marketplace rather than trying to create something and hope it sells, then create products out of things that already sell. So back in 1989, I did my first program live called 10 Powerful Marketing Strategies That Can Boost Your Sales, all right, or something like that. Forget it. My insurance company client paid me to deliver that talk, paid me very well. They paid to record the talk. They paid to edit the talk. They pay to give me a finished product of the talk live, which became essentially my first product, even though I never sold it once. But then what I did is I then, because they paid me and I already got the product because they paid me and I knew they wanted it, I traded that product back to them for probably another $50,000 in speaking engagements and training sessions. Basically, I said, look, guys, if you give me another 20 gigs at $2,000 or $3,000 a pop, I will give you the right to reproduce a set of those tapes for everybody in the room. And I won't charge you for those, except you just pay for whatever it costs you to reproduce the tapes. And they were like, wow, this guy's really good. He's so generous. And I was like, oh, this is great. You just paid me to produce a product. I own the product. It's a great product. You gave me a finished product. I can now go sell that somewhere else. Or I don't have to sell it all the time. You know, you can sometimes leave money on the table. And in exchange for you giving me another 20 dates at full fee or whatever, I'll give you as many of those as you want. You put me in front of 500 people, I'll give you a piece of paper that says you can make 500 copies. The next product I did, which was my first commercially sold product, was 21 Ways to Double Your Sales in 1991. Same scenario. They called me. They said, we want a new program this year. I said, boy, have I got a program for you. I've doubled my sales for 3 consecutive years. I just wrote a training on how I did it called 21 Ways to Double Your Sales. Okay? 21 Ways to Double Your Sales. They hire me to go and do it for a full day. I do it for a full day. They record it for a full day. They edit it. They give me back a finished product. They do a workbook. They give me back the workbook. Guess what? Not only did I get paid for 21 Ways to Double Your Sales, but I got a product, finished product, that I then went out and sold into the marketplace and sold thousands of sets of 21 Ways to Double Your Sales at $99. Okay? They paid me. How did I know that the program would work? Because they put 500 people in the room in 4 different locations. If they're willing to pay for 21 Ways to Double Your Sales, I got to believe somebody else is. And sure enough, they were. All right? And this went on literally. I could take you chronologically, but I won't. I think you get the picture. And even in situations where I was called in to speak for free, I recorded everything. And back then, you know, if you're not doing professional recording, you're recording right through a little condenser microphone in a stand-alone cassette player that that broadcasters used to take out and do little local interviews. I bought the best Marantz unit money could buy at that time. I would sit it on the desk in front of me, and I record every session, even up to 200 people. You could still hear that program. That little Marantz recorder, which cost me $300, made me tens of thousands of dollars. Why? Because I recorded everything. Now, was everything quality enough and content rich enough to sell? No. But everything has value. Either it has value as a bonus, it has value as a promotion, it has value as a marketing tool, it has value as, you know, give away the what, sell the how, that kind of thing. Okay? And that went all the way up to my flagship products, like Max Sales, which in money paid $250,000, another $100,000 to produce, and then they referred me to 5 of their biggest competitors. That turned into a $1 million product. So what I'm suggesting to you is that, first off, the best way to get a product done is to get somebody else to pay for it because they want it, they want the content. And so even if you're doing speaking or you're doing pitches or whatever you're doing to sell your stuff, even if it's a sales pitch, get somebody to record it. And now, at the very least, it enables you to be in more than one place at one time. All right? I was sending out thousands of tapes a year for free to people who wanted to hear what do you do? What do you talk about? Well, I didn't want to spend 15 or 20 minutes on the phone every time with somebody, so I recorded a demo. Here's, you know, or I took an actual interview. Or better yet, I gave them a real-life training program you know, a 90-minute or a 60-minute training program. And so we built up this massive library, not only of content that people would buy and pay for, but we also built up an amazing library of marketing tools that people would use, or that we would use, you know. So, and just as an aside, for the 21 Ways to Double Your Sales, that program, when you become a player for life, we're going to give you the ability to give away that program so that you can attract people, you know, to your website, let's say, or that you can attract, if somebody's willing to give you 5 referrals, and in exchange for you to give them 21 ways to double, or give them access to 21 ways to double your sales for free, that could be a really good way to build your list. All right. So as a partner for life, one of the advantages we're going to give you is one of the programs in that, because right now 21 ways to double your sales, people are selling it. They've devalued it. They're selling it on eBay for like $29, which they actually don't have permission to do, but I don't have the energy to go out after them. I'm going to just give it away. But I'm not going to give it away to give it away. If you give me the name of 5 people, would you exchange the names of 5 people who could also get 21 ways for free if I give you 21 ways to double your sales for free? It's a pretty potent offer, especially for people who want to increase their sales. All right? So what I'm saying to you about creating product, first off, is don't go willy-nilly and create a product just because you think somebody's going to buy it. That's not to say you shouldn't create a product. All I'm saying is that it's far better if you create a product out of somebody being interested already than to create a product and then hope somebody would be interested in it. That's why a lot of these product launches today require a massive amount of joint venture partners with large lists, because they don't really have a proven market for the product. They actually have to create one. And part of the creation of the market is the scarcity of it, the high pressure of it, the authority it's coming from some other guru, okay? But the truth is, if they had to, you know, really go out and prove the market first, and they didn't have the access to these, you know, large lists, a lot of these products wouldn't do very well at all. And certainly not necessarily over time, because they don't have a large enough audience. They have to do a $1 million product launch from 1,000 people in order for that thing to really pay off. Because under normal circumstances, maybe 1,000 people, given a normal buying cycle as opposed to a shrunken selling cycle, might not otherwise buy these products. Okay? Now, that's not to say that if you have a product, don't go do a product launch. You know, I plan to do one for Player for Life for, you know, with all the people that I know. But again, just so that you realize, you know, I've always felt like truth trumps all. That when you tell the truth, always, you always stand to gain. You really can't lose. Because if the truth is that you ought not buy something from me, then we're better off dealing with the truth than you buying something and being disappointed, or buying something and not getting results, or buying something and say, geez, I got terrible buyer's remorse, I ought not have done that. That undermines the long-term viability of a business relationship and the profitability of a customer. Okay? So I've got about 6 minutes left on this tape. Well, it's digital, and then I'd have to come back and do it again. I have about 30 minutes worth of stuff to cover, so I have a choice here, and I need at least one of you to stay here with me. If I go another 30 minutes, is there anybody who can hang in there for 30 more minutes? And if not, then I will wrap up now. So if somebody can stay with us for 30 minutes, would you please come out and say, yes, I can stay? Okay, very good. So what I'm going to do then is I'm going to kind of wind down here. I don't know that Mitch, I've – yeah?
I'll stay for 30 minutes.
Okay, we got somebody willing to stay. All right, we got somebody who is a glutton for punishment. And so.
Hi, Mitch.
Yeah.
Mitch, it's Peter. I joined late, but I'll stay for 30 minutes.
Okay, all right. So here's what I'm going
to
do.
I want to know, Mitch, is how do we get a copy of this recording?
Oh, that's the trick. Well, for $14.95,
no. Well, five people.
Yeah, no. That's a great idea.
Mitch.
That's what I should do. No, because you're already in my community, you're going to get access.
Hi, Mitch. It's John and Dawn from Cape Town, but we're actually in Washington today.
Oh, hey, welcome to the U.S.
Thanks. We got on a bit late because we had problems, but we want to stay.
Okay, great. And maybe I'll even go another hour. I'll really punish you guys.
Thank you, Mitch.
So here's what I'm going to do, because we have just a couple of more minutes, and then what I'm going to do is you can stick around. Don't get off the line. Stay on the line. Just going to take like half a minute or so to grab a drink, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to talk to you about some really important deals and some really good stuff, which I didn't get to cover yet. All right,
Mitch.
Yeah.
Before you leave, I was going to mention one thing. My name is Steve. I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
The point you just made about the joint venturing and putting a product out to market without even knowing there's a market there, but letting a joint venture, partners push into their list, you know, in terms of numbers, I had never heard it expressed that way before, and it makes perfect sense. Not that it's a good thing, but that it's a numbers thing.
A great point. It is a numbers thing. And that's the whole idea. If you have the numbers, go for it. But you do notice that a lot of these product launches, there's a circle of people that they all put them out together. And so if you can build that kind of thing or crack into that, you could do very well. If not,
the other thing that goes on is I get mail from 10 different people
right.
selling the same thing because they're all on each other's list.
Yep.
And that drives me nuts, and it drives other people nuts as well.
Well, and what it does is it puts a bitter taste in your mouth. So even if you're inclined to do it, you kind of feel like you're part of a herd of people being run off a cliff. You know, you don't feel any sense of, you know, this is really for me. Like, he's speaking to me, you know. It's just a numbers game. And again, I'm not judging it. If you can do it and make $1 million or $100,000 or $10,000, by all means, do it. But what I've learned is, and how you stay in business for a long time, is you make sure that the people you think want it already want it, and that's such an easier sale to make, to give people something they already want, and that's also part of why they're going to this new continuity model, is because they realize that if you buy a $1,000 package, but you don't like it, you're going to return it, and the game is over. Whereas if you buy the $1,000 package, I can get you to like it if I can stay in the game long enough to work with you. And the only way I can do that is if I'm in the game with you consistently, continuously. Okay?
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to switch off so that we can start the re-recording for part two. I would love to open up part two like Steve did. If there's anything you want to jump in and ask about, you want to get more clarity on, you want more elaboration. I've got another 5 or 10 things to cover, but, you know, I'd always much rather have you come in and share something, and then I can riff off of what you do, okay? So this is going to be the end of part one, and then we're going to come back here. You stay on the line. I'm just going to switch off. And I'll be back in less than about a minute, okay? So hang on.